Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and we are going to be talking today about billionaires, why there are so many of them in geopolitics, why we have to care about what these very, very rich people are doing and how they're affecting the rest of us. My guests today are Carole Annaux, the head of Brussels Center for European Policy Studies, and David de Jong, who has written a book about Nazi billionaires, when another period in history when we had people very much concerned about the rise of wealth in the private sector interacting with governments. And we're going to talk about what this means for Europe, for the US, and for the world around us. Carole, let's start with the present day. What does it mean to have these very rich people in charge of these very powerful companies? And what does it mean for Europe in particular, since many of them come from the United States?
The fact there are so many billionaires in the US shows already what the problem it is. For the world economy, let's say that we already are so much focused on the United States, of the distortions which are caused by having such an attractive capital market in the United States, which highlights immediately what the problem is for Europe, that apparently we cannot create wealth in the same way as the United States can do. And that is not related to the fact that we tax much more. It's just that the capital market in the United States functions so much better than the capital market in Europe. Say that the wealth creation or the capacity to create capital to invest in new companies is so much more prominent in the United States than it is in Europe. Let's say, which then highlights immediately the economic problem behind it, the welfare which you can create. And that's what we need to think about in such a debate. And that's also what the Trump administration says continuously. The welfare you can create in the US is so much higher than what is in Europe. And which is, of course, a problem for Europe. If you want to maintain the welfare state as we have it in Europe, it is so difficult. If we cannot create wealth like in the United States, how could we maintain our welfare state?
There are less than 4,000 billionaires in the world, according to a Wall Street Journal report that I read. Less than 1,000 of those are in Europe. The majority are in the United States, around 1,200 or so, and then the rest are in other places. We see with taxation that there's just a frustration that these people have been allowed to amass so much, with Elon Musk possibly becoming the world's first trillionaire now that one of his companies has gone public. California has a ballot initiative in the U.S. to try and have a one-time tax on some of the tech billionaires who've been there. And they're putting money into the government. They're putting money into the electoral races, certainly all over the U.S. And then that policy is affecting things all over the world. David, what is your sense of where we are now and how they're affecting the political process?
I mean, if you're looking at the U.S., you know, there's been a massive influence of billionaires, not only in the past few election cycles, but particularly, would say, since the Supreme Court ruling of 2010, Citizens United, where super PACs came into effect, essentially. And if you're looking at how they have shaped in the 16 years since, how they've shaped election cycles, not only individual billionaires, but if you're looking, for example, at venture capital firms like Andreessen Horowitz, which were the largest spender thus far in the 2026 election cycle. So, you know, the whole gamut from Elon Musk's America PAC, where he himself donated $250 million to other billionaires, also from Betsy DeVos, a former Treasury Secretary, to other billionaires, you know, chipped in various millions. To, of course, the famous image at Trump's most recent inauguration, where you had Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google. Who else am I missing? Sam Altman, of course, the OpenAI founder. I think I mentioned Bezos and Zuckerberg. No, I don't think Brin and Page were there, the Google founders. But all the tech billionaires, basically, were present at the inauguration. And it is a clear sign during the current administration that they are really siding publicly with the administration, which they did not do during the first administration. You know, the business world at large kept its distance from the first Trump administration. And in the second one, they've embraced it very, very publicly, cozied up to them. You've seen with Meta, Zuckerberg, but also particularly with Jeff Bezos underwriting the Melania documentary. I mean, there's all kind of sycophancies going on, which we haven't previously seen, at least in the United States.
And Let's step back now. Tell us about an earlier era when we had corporate titans really getting involved in government. You wrote a whole book about this. What was that about? What inspired you? And what are the headlines out of that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at Germany, and if you're looking particularly at the Third Reich, right? But there's other historical allusions that can be made. For example, Putin's Russia. But let's start with Germany first. First of all, Nazi billionaires came into effect based on articles that I wrote for Bloomberg. I turned it into a book, moved to Berlin, spent 4 years researching and reporting on what are today's Germany's wealthiest and most influential families, like the Quan dynasty behind BMW, the Oetker family behind Dr. Oetker, the Porsche Piëch family behind Volkswagen and Porsche and other car brands, the Von Finck dynasty behind Allianz, it's a finance family, the Kühne dynasty behind the transport company Kuhne Nagel, but also other transport companies or aviation companies like Lufthansa, Brenntag, Hapag-Lloyd, and as well the Flick dynasty behind Daimler-Benz, but they were during the Third Reich the largest steel, coal, and weapons manufacturers. So, you know, I focused on families that are still relevant in global business today and that profited off the Third Reich through mass weapons production, expropriation of Jewish business families or Jewish families overall, as well as expropriations in German-occupied Europe and the exploitation of forced and slave labor across German-occupied Europe, and particularly, of course, in German factories and mines. And what I really wanted to shine a light on was the whitewashing that these families and their companies do today in celebrating their fathers and grandfathers for their business successes, but leaving out their war crimes or Nazi affiliations, you know, while they have consumer-facing massive global foundations, charitable foundations, media prizes, academic chairs that they fund, museums named after these men, corporate headquarters, I mean, you name it. That's the main thrust of the book. Now, I looked at how these families got involved with the Third Reich, which were by and large through opportunism. When Hitler seized power in 1933, it was at the tail end of a, you know, hugely economic and political volatile period. The Weimar era was ending, an era of hyperinflation. First hyperinflation ended, of course, with the Great Depression. And they were looking for economic stability. This is something that Hitler promised and also initially delivered on by initiating the largest free armament program that the world had ever seen to date. Of course, this quickly devolved into criminal behavior through anti-Semitic legislation, the expropriation of Jewish families within Germany and subsequently Austria. And of course, this is a criminal practice that continued in the German-occupied territories, and arguably with the low point, it's the estimated between 12 and 20 million Europeans that were deported to be exploited in German factories and mines. So I'm a little bit hesitant, and more than a little bit hesitant. I think for me, the most apt historical allusion is to the Putin regime. If we compare Yeltsin's Russia to the Weimar era and the volatility and kind of the devil's pact that Hitler's industrialists did, as well as Russian oligarchs formed with Putin in 2000, you know, and the great wealth that followed for all of them, I think that is the apt allusion, where we can't make those allusions just yet to the second Trump administration. Although we do see in the first year and a half that he has been in power, or in the second administration, that billionaires are lining up and showing public support in ways that have been unprecedented, truly.
It's pretty shocking even now to think about the gulf between the people who are making all of this money during World War II and the run-up and the people who suffered at the hands of it. We are, in the developed world, seeing inequality really hitting our political system. As you say, the billionaires, regardless of what they may personally believe, are donating money to the White House, funding renovations, funding parties and projects and things like that. And it seems, at least in the U.S., that this is replacing some of the cultural reputation investment that these German companies may have made. I mean, you were talking about how they had foundations, they had museums, they had cultural things. It's different from just giving a bunch of money for a party or for a ballroom. And it's different, again, from paying taxes, which is something that they all would rather not do. They'd like to have control over how they spend the money rather than participating in democracy in the way that people with less power have to. Carl, how would you thread the through line on this? How do you see it in context?
Well, the first thing we need to know, certainly from a European perspective, I cannot speak from a US perspective, is that we first need to have the base in a society to create wealth and to create welfare for everybody. And of course, then we can tax, and not vice versa. I followed the debate in some member states, like in Belgium, but also like in France, like in Italy, like in Spain. I think there is far too much focus on the fact that we need to tax rather than first to see whether we have the base for our society to continue to be prosperous, to be creating welfare. Why do I say this? I went to listen to Arthur Laffer here in Brussels 2 or 3 months ago. I was impressed. I said, let's go and give him a chance. But the guy is now 85 years old. And Arthur Laffer is the thinker behind the Laffer curve. In many European societies, we are behind the point in the Laffer curve, let's say that we still create wealth, but that we tax far too much. And he was asked the question when he was speaking about this issue, let's say about taxing billionaires and whether we do enough in Europe on that. And that he said very clearly, we first have to think about that we need to have the basis in our societies to create wealth. And then we can speak about taxation. And that's, I think, what we need to remember in Europe. Let's say we have gone beyond that point that we can create sufficiently wealth, which is also important for example, capital markets union, for the savings and investment union in Europe. But that we think far too rapidly, certainly debate in France with Piketty and the other one who's worked with him on, they focus so much. But have we still in Europe a basis which is sufficiently attractive for people to start their own enterprise, to scale up their enterprise? And if you see this proposal from the Commission on Europe Inc., which also has an element in there, let's say, for stock options, that apparently also within the European administration, they believe we don't have a context sufficiently attractive in Europe overall to make people participate in wealth creation. And I think that is the basic thing, that we shouldn't think too rapidly on taxing billionaires. We first need to think, have we still got the base to create wealth in Europe? And I think that is fundamental, that we need to have this thinking or this reflection sufficiently broadly available in European societies. How do we create wealth for our societies to survive? Also, because if you come in the United States, but the same if you come in Asia, the way they look at Europe is like, Europe will not make it anymore. Europe is behind the curve. Europe will not sustain on the long term its societies anymore. And that's why I think, for example, the reflection of somebody like Arthur Laffer, in the sense that do we have a system which is sufficiently attractive for people to grow enterprises, to create wealth for societies as a whole? And it's only then that you can think about, once we have this, we can think about, do we tax these people sufficiently? Overall, whether the taxation is sufficient, I'm fairly agnostic on that, in the sense that there will always be ways for certainly rich people to evade taxes. If it's not in Europe, they will go to other jurisdictions, and it will be extremely difficult to get down to them and to make them pay taxes. That's why we need to think about this Laffer curve. Are we still in this kind of upside part of the curve that we manage to have a system of taxation which keeps people here, keeps wealth in Europe, but also keeps incentives for people to create wealth in Europe? And I don't think you're still there in Europe and many European countries, certainly not in Belgium, certainly not in France, certainly not in the Netherlands and other countries. Of course, I know there is the counterexample of the Nordic countries, which have a very apparently high levels of taxation, but we still manage to create enterprises, scale up enterprises in a system, which is an example for many other European states, which makes European states reflect. But again, from a European perspective, we have to think about how we create wealth. And of course, the United States does that extremely well, probably in a far too elitist way, on a far too selective way, in a way which creates a hugely polarized society, which we don't have in Europe. But at least they create economic growth, which we don't have sufficiently in Europe.
Thanks so much for that. I deliberately started with the heavy stuff up front because I think it is worth thinking about just this concentration of wealth and political power. But then backing it up, we do want to think about how can we have a better society. And all those points you made about growth, about company creation, about innovation really are going to be the key things for policymakers. In the next part of our podcast, I want to talk more about that, about how companies can get started, how they can work within the economy and within the policy environment to help the economy work for everybody rather than just channeling into this very specialized sense of winners and all the rest of us. In terms of taxes, little housekeeping, there are now two tax observatory projects funded by the European Commission. One of them is Gabriel Zucman's arm, which is looking very much at wealth and wealth taxation. And the other one is the one that some of my colleagues at Bruegel have just started, looking specifically at economic growth and how tax structures for businesses and other things can improve growth. So that's something people who are interested in can look in the show notes. But coming back to this conversation, we're looking at how can companies get started and how can they grow without becoming overly concentrated. David, do you have any thoughts about that? The Silicon Valley tech revolution was great for everybody for a long time. And now we're in sort of this transition period where people who cashed in early on that are monetizing everything, in-shitifying, as Cory Doctorow would say, many of the products. And we don't seem to have these societal gains, so we're slipping back. What's the next wave going to look like?
I mean, you're seeing it in San Francisco, right? What the transition that's happening is that, well, of course, for so many decades, it was Silicon Valley. Now, actually, companies like Anthropic, OpenAI, they're all actually based in San Francisco. And you're seeing people who are making $180,000, $200,000 in San Francisco being priced out by the money that the AI wave is making, which is so perverse, I would say, and it is a dystopian. And well, there's massive amounts of wealth being generated, you know, especially through the IPOs. I mean, look at SpaceX, which made Elon Musk briefly the first ever dollar trillionaire in the world. We will see what later this year, the OpenAI Anthropic IPOs that are most likely slated will bring. But it is San Francisco, especially with the discrepancies there in wealth, right? The NIMBY behavior also by the local billionaires refusing to tackle the huge issues with homelessness throughout San Francisco, but out the larger Bay Area. I would say San Francisco is kind of the worst example in that sense. But in a bigger picture, you know, I started my career in 2011 working for this new team that Bloomberg created, which was focused on hidden wealth. And we really started in the fall of 2011 in New York when Occupy Wall Street was, of course, raging through, had based itself in downtown Manhattan, in Zuccotti Park. And in those 15 years, right, we can see the development of Bernie Sanders right now spawning his acolytes like Mamdani and AOC, becoming hugely, hugely popular and successful across the political spectrum, really also appealing broad swaths of the American public. It really all started, and the underlying issue still is, the ever-growing wealth inequality in the United States and globally. It's not an American issue. It's a global issue, which has not been sufficiently addressed. You know, in 2011, the feeling was either this is going to get tackled now. I mean, it was a time of Occupy Wall Street, David Graeber, Bullshit Jobs that he famously wrote, and other of the incredible works. But also, it was this time where you feel, okay, this is going to get tackled or it's not. And it's gone exponentially worse in the past 15 years. And you're seeing this as a result also, this massive political change, particularly in the U.S. with the following that he has spawned.
There's such a political gulf even in what we talk about. Bernie Sanders, one of his trademark policies is Medicare for All, which looks a lot like single-payer healthcare, which most of the rest of the world has adopted with some success. Saram Nandani, the mayor of New York, has received so much press attention for his hope of opening a handful of subsidized grocery stores. The U.S. military runs a worldwide empire of subsidized grocery stores that no one has ever worried about, but the idea that there might be four in New York City is freaking people out. And yet, people aren't having the same freak out about, say, Google insisting that if you want to use their Chrome browser, which everyone needs to use to run any number of websites integrated in their lives, needs to now have a large memory AI component that's just baked into the browser, that's there gathering all your data, whether you want its help or not. There's a difference in what reaches people's public perception. And then on the flip side, in America, it's very much taken for granted that if you have a good idea, you can start a small company. And then when you're ready, you can go look for investors to help you and give you more money to hire more people. And then eventually you might take it public or something like that. In Europe, we have a lot of people with very good ideas coming out of the educational system, they start their small company, and then when they're ready to get bigger, more often than not, they go where the money is, and more often than not, there's not a place for that in Europe. So they go to the US. Carol, you've been working on capital markets, trying to help Europe get its head around growth as something to strive for and not something to be wary of. Can I ask you to be a little bit philosophical about why letting companies ask for money at scale is such a hard thing for Europe culturally to get its head around?
Of course, first of all, Europe is a constellation of many different countries, which have different cultures, different traditions, and different ways of looking at these matters. Secondly, we still have a very, as compared or unlike the United States, we still have a very strong egalitarian tradition in Europe, certainly in many European countries. For example, in Belgium, Belgium has one of the lowest Gini coefficient, one of the lowest degrees of inequality, just because the tax system is so progressive. From a feeling that this is the best way to stimulate the harmonious society. So it has to do with a societal approach that if you have a tax system which is extremely progressive, it leads to a harmonious society. It leads to a society where there is consensus, where there is a belief, let's say, that we all strive for the same things. However, to export this then, first of all, at the European level, and to discuss this even less at a global level is extremely difficult because societies will have totally different approaches on this, as we see from this discussion, certainly with the United States. Of course, we see approaches at the European level to have a bit this model at a European level. But again, it leads us back to the question, can we create sufficient wealth to maintain such a system at an EU level, at a European level? And if we have such a system, is it not bad for wealth creation on the long term? And I think that's the basic question which we have at the moment. Our system is far too egalitarian to certainly keep the very rich from raising their funds in Europe, starting their business or keeping their business in Europe and thinking, look, I can better do this in the United States. And in the end, we create a system which at the global level, because we want to have a globally integrated market, is distorting in the sense that the rich, the powerful, the people with ideas go to the United States because they can stay rich there, they can raise money there, and then they leave the European context where they pay little or no taxes, which then creates a debate as we have it today, which we have in France or with others and other European countries. Again, we have other examples of states where it works in Europe, like Sweden, which is the best example, the Swedish financial system, where you can apparently create wealth, create new enterprises, and keeping money locally and keeping a system, a social system functioning as it is. So again, it is not easy question to answer what we could do best. Personally, if I look at other indicators of wealth creation in Europe, we know that, for example, Europe's healthcare system is much less expensive than it is in the United States because we have a form of a mutual insurance system. And the US system is extremely individual, but much more expensive because you can better share the cost of a health insurance than do it all individually. But also life expectancy, also, for example, education and so on, which in Europe seem to be much better organized at a lower cost than it is in the United States. So we shouldn't give up too rapidly our European system. We have to have a very deliberate discussion about this. But I think what we have in Europe, this focus on competitiveness at the moment, this focus on, look, we are losing out in the long term if we don't manage to create wealth, is extremely important. And I hope the current discussion will lead to a better system for Europe to create wealth and to have welfare creation in the European context. Although on the short term, Rebecca, just to find a way that we can have a capital market which is as attractive as it is in the United States is extremely difficult. That's the core of the problem. We have a system where banks are very dominant in the financial system, which have no interest in having a system where you could go to the capital markets directly, and in this sense, make it less attractive for people to raise funds in the European market and send them to a system probably at the global level, which is the most attractive one, which is the United States, where you have a capital market, which is almost more important than a banking system or a financial system based on bank financing, as you have it in the United States.
I've thought for a long time that if we could get European healthcare and US-style capital markets in the same place, we could really do some amazing things.
I appreciated your bringing up Belgium and Sweden as examples, because they both have progressive taxation. They both have a very different economic structure than the U.S., but they have such different results in terms of how they get companies going and how they invest in those companies. And I do think a lot of it comes down to investment culture. In Sweden, there's more than 100 years of expectation that regular people will invest in companies, will hold shares. And in Belgium, there's a real reluctance to buy financial instruments, instead focusing on things like real estate. And there's just really different approaches to risk. In the last part of our podcast, I'd like to talk some more about that risk and maybe also tie it back to the political risks we were talking about in the beginning. David, how do you see risk-taking playing a role, both in economic growth and also in the way these very rich people pivot toward political power? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Jeff Bezos at Amazon and a lot of these guys were investing in climate and were investing in culture, and now they've completely changed. To back out the question a little more, how can we think about the risk that these billionaires perceive versus the risks that the rest of us have in trying to figure out what to do?
It is quite shocking, right? And I think Bezos and Zuckerberg are the most pertinent examples at this time. Because when you're talking about risk, right? I mean, yeah, Jeff Bezos took a risk when he founded Amazon in 1996 from his parents' garage and started shipping books from there. Mark Zuckerberg took a risk when he dropped out of Harvard after founding the Facebook. You know, they quickly found backers and investors. Fast forward 30 years, 20 years, you know, now in terms of risk, what's risk for them, right? With the money that Jeff Bezos spent on bankrolling the Melania documentary, which to the tune of 50, 60 million, he could have employed the 450 Washington Post journalists that he fired in the first week of February this year for multiple years, right? One, you know, the tagline of the Washington Post, democracy dies in darkness. Well, my wife watched the Melania documentary. Well, that's where democracy dies in darkness, right? I mean, really, you cannot have a more kind of sycophantic tributary than these kinds of productions. So what are they risking, right? For a guy like Jeff Bezos, well, it's about Amazon and Amazon getting certain federal contracts, or Blue Origin. His space company getting certain federal contracts, which, you know, he was such a stalwart of journalism during the first Trump administration. I read Marty Barrons, who was the editor-in-chief of the Washington Post under Bezos from 2013 through 2021. And he was, in his book, so very, you know, he lauded Bezos for when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered by Saudi Arabia in the Saudi consulate in Turkey.
Ankara or in Istanbul.
Yes, exactly, in Istanbul. And he was really a champion of journalism. But now the risk that he's taking, in his mind, it seems to be the calculation he's making is, I want to be on the right side of the administration. Whether that puts him on the wrong side of history, the coming years will show. But the man has hundreds of billions, as does Mark Zuckerberg and all the others. So there's not so much risk anymore. There's no personal risk. There is a slight entrepreneurial risk, but it is all quite negligible, right? So the sycophancy is really shocking. And you're seeing it also with Mark Zuckerberg, particularly with regards to Meta's removing all of those that are keeping oversight. They fired all of the oversight on platforms so that it's now basically an uncensored platform. It was one of the first moves that they made under the current Trump administration. The risk that they're perceiving is falling out with the current administration, which is such a vengeful administration. I mean, they're going after journalists. So, you know, if they put fear in the wealthiest and most influential people in the world, right, because that is clearly it, then in a sense, that's the risk that they're perceiving.
I appreciate your bringing up the risks in the U.S. to journalists right now, because we've just seen the New York Times be subpoenaed for reporting that there are differences in the government contracted plane that has transported the presidents of the United States for generations with the one that the current president, Donald Trump, received as a gift from the government of Qatar and retrofitted in record time. It's the sort of thing that if you put it in a novel, it would be hard to believe that something like this could happen, and yet it's happening. So it's not just the perennial journalist grouching that they don't get enough or the right access. Are there lessons in terms of the relationship between the heads of big companies, big industry, and governments from history do you think voters should think about now in terms of who they would like to be in government and what policies they would like to head for going forward?
I think the biggest warning is that, or the historical message, I would say, is that businessmen have agency. Industrialists, financiers, CEOs, business heirs, they have agency. Because I think one of the largest excuses was always, oh, we didn't have a choice during the Third Reich, for example. They had a choice. There's the example of Fritz Thyssen, who was the steel mogul and was one of Hitler's earliest backers, financial backers, one of his few industrial financial backers, actually, from 1925 onward, who ended up being member of parliament in a defunct Reichstag and voting against the German invasion of Poland in September 1939. And as a result, his steel empire was expropriated, was put under trusteeship, and he fled to Paris, was arrested there after the German invasion of France, and ended up being put in a concentration camp, survived, was of course detained by the Allies because he was one of Hitler's earliest backers, and actually ended up being prosecuted by both sides. Fritz Thyssen is not a shining example to hold up in any way, but he did make a choice, right? I mean, if one of Nazi Germany's most influential industrialists can take a bizarre symbolic stance against the German invasion of Poland, there was certainly a choice to be made. All the other men that I wrote about did not make that choice. They ended up staying and profiting. I would say the message to the wider business world is you always have a choice. There's always agency, because I think often people act as if it's predetermined, you know, it's like determinism, but that's not the case. There's massive agencies, and that's something that voters also should not forget when they hold politicians and those that pay for campaigns and those that seek to influence campaigns through their donations or seek to influence politicians through their donations, is that politicians have a choice and businessmen and women have a choice. They have agency. I think that is something that is often forgotten by voters by and large.
Carl?
On that subject, I mean, I would say that sometimes we far too much look at the businessman as being the savior of a country, but we shouldn't forget there's this fundamental difference between being in charge of a private business, of being in charge of a government, and being in charge of a country. Sometimes we think that Bezos or a Musk or a Gates will be the ones who will inspire how to manage a country, but we've seen it far too often that this is a misguided belief, because it's a fundamental difference, and that's what you do at think tanks, to think about public policy than to think about private policy interests. And overall, I think there's far too much thinking in our Western society about how to manage private business, but there's insufficient thinking about how to manage in a sound way public business, which is the things which we've been discussing just now. How can we create prosperous states where interests of many different groups in a society are aligned? And we do not only think about the rich, which are an element of that, which we can tax and which can generate revenues for the state, but also which take care of a big share of employment. But there is also the state, which is easily in many European societies 50%, a bit less, sometimes a bit more, of the GDPs. So the whole educational system, the hospitals, the state governance system is managed and costs as well. But to make that function well, I think overall is insufficiently of a focus. Of course, we discuss politics on a day-to-day basis, but that's mostly about people. But then how the policies work and whether these policies are efficient, I think, is insufficiently looked at. Of course, that's what you do in think tanks, to look at cost-benefit of many different policies. But it is still insufficiently researched and should be much more of a focus of the thinking, because, yeah, focusing on a few people which are very, very rich, it will not help us, I think, in solving the question, let's say, what are the best policies in a given domain for a certain society?
Such a great point. We often talk about public-private partnerships, like private sector money is going to parachute in and fix everything, instead of thinking about what is the role of government in providing public goods, which almost by definition are things that the private sector is not doing, that there isn't an economic rationale for any one actor to do, but that we collectively as a society need. This has been such a great conversation, and I really appreciate your willingness to range a bit widely and a bit more philosophically around these topics. David, anything you want to add as we close out? Anything I should have asked you and haven't?
No, I think we covered many bases.
Carl?
My final point would be that we certainly, from a European perspective, need to think very carefully if we think we need to tax the rich, as I said in the beginning, whether we already don't tax sufficiently, and whether there are sufficient ways to think in our societies, many European countries, whether we can scale back to some degree our welfare states, which is my last point. Do we sufficiently think whether the money which we spend as a state is sufficiently well spent and serve the purposes for which they're there? If you think about a country like France, which is spending so much these days on pension systems, which is basically spending money on those which have created wealth in the past, but taxing them so much, the people which are working today, I mean, is something which we really have to think about very carefully. Because I think in many European countries here are over this point of the Laffer curve, where we're already taxing far too much to create or keep incentives for people to contribute to wealth creation in societies.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I have been joined today by author David de Jong and Carl Lano, head of the Center for Economic Policy Studies, who has been such an inspiration to me in the think tank and Brussels policy world for the last 10 years, and whose insights I'm very grateful to have on the show today. Thank you both for coming on. We'll be linking to some of our related research and David's book and other things like that in the show notes. You can find Sound of Economics archives for free on our website and on all your favorite podcast platforms. Thank you for listening. See you next time.